He served as president of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, the American Society of Engineering Education, and a whole list of others, all national societies. He's the author of several important engineering books and literally hundreds of articles and papers on power engineering and engineering education. He's a Lamé medalist, 1940, received the Washington Award in 1943. Now I'm going to introduce Dean A.A. Potter of Purdue University as a personal friend who I have known for these many years, Dean Potter.
Dr. Willard, President Williamson, Provost Griffith, Professor Parker, members of the engineering college staff of the university, and other friends. As the oldest dean of engineering in captivity, it's my privilege on this occasion to bring greetings to the University of Illinois from the engineering teachers of this country. I know that all are deriving an enormous amount of satisfaction that the University of Illinois has an unusually fine plant in mechanical engineering. Of course, the University of Illinois has contributed richly to engineering education, to engineering research, and to public service. Dr. Willard mentioned the American Society of Engineering Education, which used to be called the Society for Promotion of Engineering Education. That particular society was conceived by a professor of the University of Illinois, Professor Ira Baker, Professor of Civil Engineering, who was the first president of the Society for the Promotion of Engineering Education. The University of Illinois was the first institution in this country to realize the value of research in engineering. Has since that time been followed with practically every land-grant college and university in this country, as well as by a great many state and privately endowed institutions. I know of very few institutions of higher learning who have contributed so richly and who have had such a large array of distinguished people in the field of engineering education as has Illinois. Several were mentioned. Nobody mentioned Professor Talbot, one of the greatest contributors to the field of materials. No one mentioned Professor Parr, who did some of the finest work in the field of fuel technology. Or Professor Willard, before he outlived his usefulness as a professor and became a president. His work in heating him and air and ventilating, and Professor Moore, Professor Wilson, you mentioned Professor Goodenough, and Professor Lutweiler. In other words, I could go on and name dozens of people who have been professors of engineering at the University of Illinois who have contributed most richly, not only to engineering education, but to American industry and to the engineering profession. And it seems to me that on this important occasion, as we are gathered to celebrate the dedication of this new mechanical engineering building, it may be well for us to reflect on the factors which have contributed to American industrial supremacy and to appraise the responsibilities of the American Engineering College in a world at peace. Some have attributed the industrial supremacy of Americans to our great natural resources, not realizing that natural resources alone are of very little value unless the people possessing such resources have specialized knowledge, creativeness, and vision to develop and to utilize these resources for the benefit of humanity. Americans have progressed industrially more than any other nation in history. and have attained the highest standard of living known to civilized peoples, not by depriving other people of their property by trickery or banditry or by offensive warfare, but by creating new wealth in the form of new articles of commerce, new materials, new processes, new devices, new products, new industries, and new utilities. Very few people realize that more than half of the epoch-making practical inventions of the past 150 years are definitely the results of American creative genius. Americans have, during that period, been the pioneer inventors and major contributors in the fields of communication, transportation, illumination, mechanized agriculture, manufacturing, power generation and transmission. The airplane, the steamboat, the telegraph, the telephone, television, the incandescent lamp, the harvester, the reaper, the typewriter, the talking machine, the cinema, and the linotype are but a few of the hundreds epoch-making inventions of Americans, as are the practical processes for the manufacture of celluloid, aluminum, vulcanized rubber, and many other modern articles of commerce. Now, ladies and gentlemen, America is great and creative, not because it has a monopoly in brains or in genius, but by reason of the fact that for over 160 years, this country has had a government which has encouraged its people to invent more, to produce more, and to have more than any other people in recorded human history. Inventiveness does not flourish in a totalitarian state where people are enslaved and deprived of their initiative under an impractical, non-competitive ideology which claims to protect the common people. In addition to our government, I am convinced that education has made an important contribution to the industrial supremacy of this country. Interest in education is a national characteristic of Americans who are willing to tax themselves in order to provide a maximum amount of schooling for the youth of this country. The University of Illinois is definitely an indication of the vision and wisdom of the people of the state of Illinois in this regard. Most of all, people consider education as an investment in free men and as a vehicle by which our young people may become better and happier citizens. Enrollment in our colleges and universities has increased about 10 times during the past 50 years, while our population has hardly doubled during the same period. The radio, the movie, the newspaper, and our array of magazines all contribute to the high level of intelligence of our people. The effectiveness of advertising in this country is definitely the result of the wide distribution of educational opportunities. Now, all of us must realize that industry, jobs, and prosperity depend upon customers and the will to have. Unfortunately, there are millions and millions of people the world over who haven't any ambition to have anything. Our educational system has developed in Americans that will to have to a greater degree than any other people in the entire world. Our industry has prospered because the people of this country are not satisfied with mere existence, but have been anxious to acquire and to use the latest creations of industry and new devices to relieve drudgery in the home, factory, and farm. That American habit of becoming dissatisfied with an automobile or any other possession after we see something better. I rode today in a very nice new car, and I'm very much dissatisfied with my car. I think that's a very good thing. It's that sort of a thing, ladies and gentlemen, but which produces jobs and produces opportunities. Our industry prospered because the people of this country, as I said, have always wanted the best and are ready to work hard in order to be able to satisfy their wants. This will to have is definitely the result of the American type of education and has been an important contributing factor to our high industrial productivity. That American industry has long realized the value of engineering education is evidenced by the fact that the ratio of engineers to our total population has increased from 131 per 100,000 in 1880 to 12,282, or practically 100 times in a period of, as if in a period from 1880 to 1940. Since 1940, the engineers of this country have increased again by about another 40%. Membership in engineering societies has increased more than 22 times during the first half of this century. The total number of engineers has increased more than three times as fast as would be accounted for by the growth of the five major industries in which most engineers are employed. The reason for this is there is a rapidly growing demand for engineers in fields outside of engineering and public works. And in this connection, may I make a statement which I am ready to prove, and that is that this country is at the present facing a shortage of engineers. Unfortunately, certain releases which were made by our own United States Department of Labor have given an absolutely wrong impression about the opportunities for engineers and engineering graduates. We are not graduating too many engineers. We are going to have a very serious shortage within the next 2 or 3 years. About a year ago now, Winston Churchill, at the mid-century convocation of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which was held in Cambridge, has made the following public statement. I quote, "We have suffered in Great Britain by the lack of colleges of university rank in which engineering and the allied subjects are taught. Industrial production depends on technology, and it is because Americans have realized this and created institutions for advanced training of large numbers of high-grade engineers to translate the advances of pure science into industrial techniques, that their output per head and consequent standard of life are so high. It is surprising that England, which was the first country in the world to be industrialized, has nothing of comparable nature." Quotation closed. Since that address, Mr. Churchill has asked for considerable literature about the land grant act and the land grant institutions, or what we are doing in engineering education in the United States. He feels very definitely that what Great Britain is more engineers, and more of the type of engineers that Americans have been producing during the past 75 years. Engineering education in this country rests on a foundation of science and of humanities, as well as of social relationships. It is an integrated program of study with scientific, technological, humanistic, and social science subjects extending throughout the entire undergraduate curriculum. Our engineering college graduates are making contributions where science is applied to the problems of industry, commerce, and public works, and where work must be organized systematically with due regard to human values as well as to costs and returns. The question is, what of the future? The key to our industrial supremacy is greater and more economical productivity under a competitive free economy. If we produce more at low cost, our standards of living will rise, as we shall be in a position to buy more. More goods at lower prices mean larger sales, and larger sales mean more employment, and more careers, and more opportunities. The greatest need at the present time is to make the public mind definitely conscious of the dire necessity of creating more wealth by producing more rather than by dividing what we have. We have never produced enough to supply the needs of our own people. Even in this great country, with our unusually high standard of living, 2/5 of our homes have inadequate modern facilities. 2/5 have no central heating. 1/5 has no electricity. 2/5 have no telephones. By utilizing our abilities to produce, we can elevate the standard of living, not only of Americans, but also of the peoples of other lands. American industry has plenty of capacity to produce to meet all demands, as it's sufficiently progressive to keep its equipment at maximum effectiveness. The human beings who are the masters of the machine must, however, be willing to do their part, and that is to go to work. No other economy has equaled ours in the ability to produce more and more, not by increased human drudgery, but by investing in using better machinery better tools, and improved production methods. There are some people who are now demanding less science and less engineering and a return to the good old days when our economy was largely on the subsistence level. Now what is actually needed is more science and more technology, widely directed and wisely guided. We have learned during recent years the value of science and of engineering in waging mechanical wars. To maintain our security under present world conditions, we must keep our scientific and our engineering knowledge at a high level as a basis of national preparedness. Also, more and more science and better engineering can repair the damages of war the world over, can open practical frontiers without military opposition, and make it possible for our country to become self-sufficient with regard to the needs of our people while elevating the living standards of people of other lands. We must convince the people of the world over that scientific and engineering knowledge are a great deal cheaper and a great deal safer than mechanized warfare, and that a nation can obtain abundant life and self-sufficiency much more cheaply and much more safely by making maximum use of science and technology than through trickery, banditry, and offensive warfare.